Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Good morning, New Orleans, and a beautiful morning it is. I am so glad, to be back here in the Crescent City, back home. Had a great trip. Want to thank everybody for reaching out, sending texts, sending emails, wanting to know where I was. I went on a two-week vacation. I'd never really been on two-week vacations for the 40 years that I was in law enforcement. Last year was the first time. Really enjoyed it. This year, we did it again. We went up the Rhone River in the Provence region of France and had a great time out that way. And just wanted to thank everybody for checking in on me, wanting to know whether I was ill or sick or what the situation was, and really appreciate everybody's concern. Everything was okay. Had a great time overseas. Went to Spain, went to Barcelona. Beautiful city, cleanest city I have ever been in. Just, I don't know what they do, but whatever they do, we should mimic it here. It got to the point by day two, I was looking for a piece of garbage. I was on a mission. I wanted to find litter. And I couldn't find it. And we went all over. It was incredible trip. Interesting about France, I'd never been to France, never been to Paris, and happened to be there with the tragic fire with the Cathedral of Notre Dame. And it was interesting. Obviously, it became the subject that everybody wanted to talk about. It didn't matter. I mean, obviously, the people of France were in a state of shock. We were in Provence at the time. We were just south of Lyon, and we were pulling into Lyon when we heard of the fire. It was complete disbelief, and it didn't matter whether we were visiting a vineyard, a truffle farm, a silk shop, a lavender store. The discussion always seemed to move quickly from their products to their beloved Notre Dame. And, you know, it's funny because within just a couple of days, the mood seemed to move very quickly from disbelief to relief when it was being announced of the major French corporations that were making significant donations to rebuild Notre Dame. And it was funny, when it first came to the forefront, I was wondering what order was actually responsible for the property. Did not know that it was actually owned by the state, that the country of France actually owns the property. And when all of the corporations, I think within the first 24 or 36 hours, they'd raised about 330 million euros, which is somewhere just south of about 400 million U.S. dollars. It was incredible, and the money just kept coming in and coming in. And then there seemed to be a second wave of relief that came across when the sources said that it was not terrorism and that it was probably an electrical source that started the fire. And it was, you could tell there was this relief. That coupled with the money coming in, it seemed as though everybody had this feeling that Notre Dame would be restored to its original beauty. And not having ever seen it before, we were scheduled to see it on Good Friday. And we got to Paris on Holy Thursday. And so didn't get to see Notre Dame as it once stood. And, you know, so the relief you could see had come over the French. And we visited Notre Dame, the area. It was kind of odd, though. We got there, and it was very much almost treated like it was a terrorism situation because they had two blocks around Notre Dame cordoned off by the police, and the police presence around Notre Dame was unbelievable. I mean, they were all over the place. Of course, on one side is Notre Dame is bounded by the river, and on three sides of it by the surrounding neighborhoods. And they had about two blocks cordoned off and it was all controlled by the police. And if you lived within that area, you had to present your ID, and we saw that happen a number of times. So it was kind of surreal to a certain extent. So when we went, it was amazing. It was one vantage point from across the river where you could actually see the damage. And I got to tell you, there were tens of thousands of people, if not 30,000 or more people, just clogging the streets. There was gridlock in Paris because of this whole situation. And there were people praying. There were people singing. There were people crying. You saw everything as it related to just this iconic cathedral and what it meant to so many people in Paris and in France and around the world. Obviously, there were a number of tourists that were there, and it was just heart-wrenching to see the range of emotions that everybody had while on that scene. And obviously, the damage was enormous. The spires were gone. In fact, we had been on top of the Arc de Triomphe earlier that day, and you could not see Notre Dame on the horizon like you once could, according to some folks that were up there and we were talking to them. So it was kind of interesting. Saturday night, we went on a dinner cruise, and it was one of the most touching moments, I have to honestly say, that I've experienced in my life. And as you go down the Seine River, you pass immediately adjacent to Notre Dame. And they had a beautiful French singer on this dinner cruise that was singing these beautiful French songs. And when we approached Notre Dame, she stopped. And they had someone come on the PA system and explain what was going on and what happened, in case anybody didn't already know, and I'm sure everybody did. And then she sang, as we passed Notre Dame, in this beautiful French voice, the most incredible, beautiful rendition of Ave Maria that I've probably ever heard. And I can honestly tell you, I don't know that there was a dry eye on the entire boat. And as I'm telling you the story right now, I have chills down my spine. And it was just amazing that the tourists that probably 99% of the people on the boat were tourists, the touching moment that everybody felt as they went down the Seine and they passed Notre Dame. And it was just an unbelievable moment, one that I thought was important to share with you, the listening audience. It was just incredibly touching. I know and I'm confident that the money continues to pour in, and they will rebuild Notre Dame to its original grandeur, its original beauty, as a place of such importance to Christianity, to Catholic faith, and it's just something that was just incredible to see. I wish I had seen it before it was damaged, and I regret not getting there. But I don't regret that moment on the Seine Saturday night. It is a moment that I probably I will never forget in my entire life. When we come back, I said earlier, I printed the entire Mueller report on Earth Day. And I read the entire report last night from front to back. And we'll have some thoughts about that when we return. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and as I said right before the break, that I printed the report yesterday, Volume 1 and Volume 2, and read it in its entirety last evening. In fact, read Volume 2 twice. That was the obstruction portion of it, in order to try and gain a better understanding as to exactly why they reached no conclusion on it, and where they said they could not prove that he was had committed obstruction of justice, but by the same token, they did not exonerate the president as it related to his actions. And it was interesting, as I was reading through the entire report, it just kind of struck me that when you start an investigation on a faulty foundation, I guess is one way of putting it, for lack of a better term, that the final product is probably going to be the result of the faulty foundation, is that it's just going to be weak. And that's what I found as it relates to this investigation. And it hasn't moved me one way or the other from what my initial reaction was throughout. And I've said on the show many times that I find President Trump to be a neophyte in so many different ways as to the operations within the White House and within government, coming from the private sector, not having any government experience, not understanding the boundaries and the barriers, and having to work within the confines of certain structures. Otherwise, you may run violative of certain federal laws and or protections. And he clearly didn't understand his White House counsel's role, as opposed to his personal culpability and where the defining line was between a personal lawyer and White House counsel, even after being advised. And it seemed to me, and Mueller went through this in his report extensively and exhaustively, and I think that's where they really struggled in trying to reach a conclusion here, is that they recognized and realized that he was completely and totally frustrated and kind of did not know where to turn, because he comes from a situation in the private sector where he controlled all of the pieces on the chessboard on his side of the board. Well, he doesn't when you sit in the White House. Yes, you have the Article II powers as the executive office, but those are very limited in many respects. And it seemed to me, as I was reading through the report and a lot of what was said, that a lot of his, and I'm going to call them incantations because that's what they sounded like to me, was him openly vetting his frustration to staff members and proposing solutions and asking them to do things that were contrary to his best interests. They knew it. He may not have. He made requests that they refused to comply with, and they didn't. Now, I don't know how many of them actually stood up and said, Mr. President, it's not a good idea for you to go to the corner of Poydras and Loyola and pull your pants down and show your butt to all of the oncoming traffic. That's not a good idea, because that's what you're proposing to do. That's what you're about to do. Typically, when you're in these kind of positions, that's why you surround yourself with people that are smarter than you. I've been in that position, where you react initially to certain things and you make observations that are not always well-reasoned, and you're not exercising complete and total emotional intelligence, where you have full grasp of your emotions and you're openly saying things that really are not reasonable responses to the challenges being presented. That's why you want to surround yourself with people that are not going to tell you what you want to hear, but what you need to hear. And there's a huge difference there. Now, what I found just incredulous is that folks like Don McGahn and a lot of the other folks within the Trump inner circle were more worried about their job future than they were about doing their job. Because their job, in my view, is to stand up and tell the president, you can't do what you're about to do. You keep suggesting that this is what you want to do. You can't do that. You will run violative of the Logan Act or this or whatever it may be that you're trying to do, and you are going to put yourself in a situation that's not going to be healthy for you. You may be incredibly frustrated by the fact that there's a special counsel that's been appointed, but that's outside of your control. That was within Rod Rosenstein's control as the acting AG. He did it. The cow's out the barn. There's no putting the cow back in the barn now. Now, yeah, you can replace Bob Mueller, but that doesn't mean that there's not going to be another Bob Mueller right after Bob Mueller. So give it up already and move on, because that is not going to change. And I just find it a little incredulous that none of these folks, at least what's in this report, said it persistently, you can't do these things that you're doing. They kind of tiptoed through the tulips with the president on many occasions and almost wanted to tell him what he wanted to hear, and in many cases were non-responsive and just decided we're not going to do it. And they didn't do it. And it's probably what ultimately ended up saving him in many respects, because he was responding emotionally to what was ultimately happening. Now, in Volume 1, as it relates to collusion, it was interesting because in the first pages of the report, they dispelled this whole collusion terminology and said it's not a concept in law, and it's about conspiracy, not collusion. And I kind of chuckled when I read through that, and they dispelled that and they moved on very quickly and said there's no conspiracy or collusion, if you want to go there. And the obstruction was a little bit more complicated. On the Blue Runner opinion poll, has the release of the Mueller report changed your perception at all? On the Blue Runner Gumbo opinion poll, has the release of the Mueller report changed your perception at all? 86% of the respondents say no. One of the interesting things, you know, that stimulated this whole thing is that immediately after the firing of Comey, the then FBI director, by President Trump, there was a naming of special counsel Robert Mueller. The interesting thing, and it's reported on in Volume 2 on page 75, it says that substantial evidence indicates that the catalyst for the president's decision to fire Comey was Comey's unwillingness to publicly state that the president was not personally under investigation. You will recall that allegedly Comey told the president on three different occasions that he was not personally under investigation. In the week leading up to Comey's May 3, 2017 Senate Judiciary Committee, the president told Don McGahn, White House counsel, that it would be the last straw if Comey did not set the record straight and publicly announce that the president was not under investigation. You also recall that the president had said that this cloud was one that was really rendering his administration impotent, and that he wasn't able to do anything. And if Comey was willing to say to him privately that he was not under investigation, why would he not say it publicly? Which ultimately led to the president terminating Comey. This is what's outlined in the report. Interesting, though, is that when they talk about this is whether or not this is going to be obstruction, and the whole reason that Rosenstein and the cast of characters decided to have special counsel was in the immediate aftermath of the firing of Comey, is that the president appoints Andy McCabe as the interim director. Well, Andy McCabe was the individual who handled the Clinton email investigation and was also intimately involved in what was going on in the Russian investigation, as well as intimately involved in what was going on with Michael Flynn, President Trump, and everything else. So he knew all along that McCabe was going to be the next guy up, the next guy standing. And yet, after all of that, the question really is how much did Mueller know early on about all of these issues and waited 2 years in going through all of this stuff about these particular issues and whether or not there was obstruction, because this was really the predicate act that stimulated this whole thing as it related to obstruction. All of the other acts that ultimately are talked about, for the most part, with the exception of two conversations that the president had directly with James Comey about Michael Flynn, were subsequent to the firing of Comey. And I just found it odd as I read through the report that a lot of this could have been dispensed with early on, and certainly could have been dispensed with after they spent 30 hours of interviews with Don McGahn, White House counsel, who shared all of his communications with President Trump with the special counsel. Now, mind you, they really set this report up, and basically, they came straight out and said that we memorialized all of this evidence, although we reached no conclusion. We don't reach the conclusion that he obstructed justice. We don't reach the conclusion that of exoneration, but we do memorialize all of this evidence while facts are clear in people's minds and are fresh in their minds. For what purpose? And that's one of the things that I find very confusing, is that he can't come to a conclusion after 2 years on this particular issue as to whether or not anything that he did in seeking advice from staff members, making statements about things that he wants them to do that are contrary to his best interests, his staff members don't tell him but don't do what he's requested of them, and whether or not that is an attempt to obstruct justice, and whether or not that there was a failure on the part of his staff members in saying, you can't do that for these particular reasons because you would run violative of these certain restrictions on you as the president of the United States. And that's what I found completely incredulous through this entire report, is that's what actually was happening here, is that I think he was speaking out of frustration in many respects. And even went back to McGahn on two occasions after McGahn had told him, you have to talk to your private counsel. And he was just completely frustrated. And that may be the reason why Mueller did not come to a conclusion, because he realized that he was not going to be able to prove this case in obstruction because of these very instances where some of the president's staff, and I'm not blaming anybody else, because it's probably just the culture that's been developed by the president himself. He doesn't like to be told no. And that's a weakness in a good, credible leader, quite frankly. Is you got to listen to the people that are smarter than you in the room. And if you think you're the smartest one in the room, that's problem number one. And I think that's where this thing went astray for him. But I don't think that there was going to be a case of obstruction. We want to hear from you, 260-1870, or text 870-870. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and you know, in the text line, a number of people are saying, and you believe that this guy is still fit to serve. The guy was elected president. There are a lot of people that believe that he should be president. Now, whether or not they feel like he should be impeached is a different question. The facts are is that, you know, you got to look at the information that's provided, the evidence that's provided, 2 years, hundreds of witnesses, hours upon hours, 30-something or 40-something million dollars spent over a two-year period of time in this investigation. And as I read through the report, they come to no conclusion. None at all. And, you know, in the obstruction set, they say they don't exonerate him, but they don't say that he's guilty of obstruction either. Now, was he upset about it? Yeah. I mean, and in many cases, he made the comment that people have told him that if your administration becomes the subject of a special investigation, special counsel investigation, you're toast. You're impotent. Your administration will not be able to accomplish anything because all you will be doing is answering accusations. The members of Congress on the opposing party side will jump all over this, and you'll not be able to move any agenda forward through Congress while the investigation is current and alive. He understood that. Not necessarily that he did anything wrong. He maintained his innocence all along. And in fact, in Volume 1, when they talked about the collusion or conspiracy, they came out and they said there wasn't any. It wasn't that they wouldn't have loved to receive information with dirt on Hillary Clinton. But when you go back to the very beginning and you look at what ultimately happened, it was the Clinton campaign that actually solicited Fusion GPS, who solicited information from the Russians to put in the Steele dossier. Not the Trump campaign. They're the ones that actually communicated with the Russians about putting together information on opposition research against the president. They're the ones that actually engaged in a collaborative effort through a third-party intermediary with the Russians. So one begins to wonder, why aren't we investigating that? If that was a concern relative to the Trump administration, why is that not a concern as it related to Hillary Clinton? And as you read through Volume 1, thinking about those issues, you begin to wonder. It also whether or not, you know, the quite number of texts about Congress and their oversight. I don't know what questions Congress is going to ask, because they certainly don't have the tools, the threat of a grand jury, that Robert Mueller had as special prosecutor, in looking at this and the oversight. I doubt very seriously that Robert Mueller is going to go up there and start answering questions that run violative of what he's allowed to do as the special prosecutor. We'll see. Nadler seems to think there's going to be something of some consequence. I don't believe that there's going to be anything of any consequence. And when you look at the redactions, I don't think there's going to be much there either. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho. On the text line, I think America's sick and tired of this investigation stuff. Congress needs to get on with running the country. And I don't disagree with that. You know, this is the first opportunity, obviously, after having been gone for 2 weeks. I read the report last evening, and it hasn't changed my perception one way or the other on this. Were there a lot of things done by the Trump administration that were completely sloppy? Yeah. Michael Flynn was, am I a Michael Flynn fan? No. I thought he was a weak choice from day one. Same thing with Paul Manafort. I said Paul Manafort and Rick Gates were sleaze buckets. I would have never, hired those guys as two campaign advisors. They were kind of bottom of the barrel guys, and that's why a lot of the other campaigns didn't hire them. You know, and what happened? It all kind of came home to roost because no one ever gave Trump any thought that he was going to be the Republican nominee at the end of the day. And this is what happens. When you don't fully vet the folks that you're going to surround yourself with, you're going to pay the price of the sins that they bring to the administration. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.